How many of you know that the book of Jasher is mentioned in both the books of Samuel and in Judges? Now, there are some fraudulent books of Jasher, and I don't need any new books of the Bible to preach it. All I need is the 66 that are there, though I've told you more than once. Best proof to me, the canonizers were not quite as inspired as the Apostle Paul is that they picked 66 books. The way God communicates through numbers, there's no way the divine revelation would have been limited to that. And I know all about what John said, if you add to and take away, what will happen to you. That's for the book of Revelation. It has nothing to do with the rest of it. Come Sunday night, God willing, we're going to dig out of the depths of the Nag Hammurabi digs, where the Gnostic Gospels that are covering the country. Many of you are getting mailings all the time about the Gnostic Gospels. Most of the documents uncovered in the mid-1940s out of that dig are Gnostic writings. Now, Gnosticism was the first great heresy of the church. Gnosticism comes from the Greek word for knowledge. It postulates the premise that you can find in your own experience a source of knowledge that needs no objective outward criteria. Every revival movement of the church has had to deal with that problem. A lot of the modern Pentecostals, and take me kindly, I grew up in that frame, but a lot of the modern Pentecostals and faith healers are very close to resurrecting many of the Gnostic theories and concepts that divided the church in the first century. At one time, some historians have estimated 80% of the Christians of the first century were Gnostics. It was out of the French church, that foundation of the church laid by those early pioneer evangelists that came with Joseph of Arimathea, ending up ultimately in England, up the valley above Marseille, that planted the church in southern France. And Irenaeus, Bishop of Lyon, wrote his dissertation against heresy and put the church back on its historic track out of Gnosticism. Many of those groups that are pointed to as revivalist groups during the Middle Ages are Gnostics in their roots. They claim an experiential taproot. They experience truth. And as with all error, there's a germ of truth that's bent out of shape that makes it become error. And there's no error as devastating as half-truth, the truth bent just a little out of shape. These Gnostic Gospels are exactly that. They represent, many of them, frauds, attempts to bend the church into the Eastern frame of the church, where you look for God within yourself. Now, both the Hebrew and the Christian tradition, Martin Buber in his book I Thou, or the I Thou relationship, and the Christian tradition have pointed out the essential distinction between the Western Christian faith and Eastern religions is that the deepest spiritual experience of a Christian is a dialogue relationship. It's the I Thou relationship. Now, I went to Bible school, got kicked out for jazzing up the Jericho Road and a few other things. One of these days I'll tell you the whole story. And it was not for kissing the girls in the elevator. I made sure the door was shut. These theological concepts of God are handed down from seminary to seminary. You've heard me tear loose on them on occasions. It's analogous to what they taught me in education at Stanford, the saber-toothed tiger curriculum. Still teaching people to kill saber-toothed tigers long after they're extinct. They just stamp it on you like cookie jar religion. God's omniscient. God's omnipotent. God's omnipresent, jaw-breaking theological terms that sound spiritual, but when analyzed, many times are nothing but logical poetic phrases that cannot be made sensible. Now, whatever else Christianity teaches, it teaches that God moved out of the invisible world and into a tent of human flesh. And as John says, though no man hath seen God, Christ hath declared him. The word is exegesis. It's to lead from behind a curtain and put on display. Whatever else Christianity is saying, it's saying that God decided to reveal himself in understandable terms. He came to shepherds and talked about sheep, and he came to fishermen and talked about fish. And if I have a crusade, it's demystifying spiritual things, because I think that's what the essence of Christianity is. Too often the church has tried to take what God brought into time and made sensible and hurl it back into mysticism. And I used to crack my mental jaws on those concepts until I became a historian and discovered that it's just a lot of eclectic baggage that sort of swept along the stream of history. And long overdue and promised sometime this summer is a series on how we got our great doctrines in the church and how the denominational streams begin to vary. But Gnosticism was the first battle, because the Eastern religions look for God within themselves. Buddhism is a branch out of the Vedanta faith. To them, reality is so undefined and not to be brought into time, they won't even give it a name. They call it the that which is behind all that. And the thing that's wrong with mankind is his identity with appearance or things that he sees and feels in the wheel of life. And nirvana, or the salvation experience that moves into Buddhism, but all of them are rooted in the Vedanta faith out of India, you literally lose consciousness of yourself, stop the onflowing flow of karma, and become identified with the that which is behind all that in this enlightenment experience. And once having attained it, you then live out the build up karma or inertia force of past life, and then are escaped from this wheel of life. God, therefore, is in you in all things. You find him inwardly. And the deepest spiritual experience is the cessation in a trance-like state of normal communicative activity. The Mauni in India takes a vow of silence. One of their branches believes that original sin is language, where you specify and break reality up into parts. And in their spiritual seeking after reality, they take a vow of silence, discipline themselves to look at the sun. Some go blind in the activity, but their goal of life is to see it as undifferentiated color without distinction. And original sin is words that break it up. Western religions are realistic in epistemology or theory of knowledge. And God is other than me. And the deepest religious experience is a dialogue relationship. That's why prayer in the Western religion is so important. Now, some try to merge them. I remember a medieval mystic who thought you could so walk with God you needn't pray. And you know my feelings about public prayer. Jesus said, do it yourself. The communication with God ought to be as natural as communication with anyone else. Certainly undergirded with respect and awe because of God's nature. One of the deepest saints whose lives I've ever studied used to set a chair down and talk to God as though he was as real as a person unseen sitting in the chair. But it's dialogue. Reinhold Niebuhr built his neo-orthodox faith on that. And as I've said, Martin Buber hit at that in what he called the I-Thou relationship in Hebrew history. God is other than me. God's not me. Whatever God may be, he turned loose a monster, you and me. And he gave to us something he valued because it's the necessary ingredient from which love flows. He gave freedom. That's why I prize it so much. I've said many times, if I didn't worship God, I'd worship the opportunity to be free. But I'm not far off from God in that view. He valued freedom because of what freedom can give, love freely given. Enough to risk sin, which is the misuse of it. He turned the monster loose. But our experience with God is a dialogue relationship. We communicate with him. in prayer. The Gnostics are a reversion to the Eastern religion. Now, part of the fullness of time that is claimed in Scripture is that set time when God sent forth His Son. And His Son, the Greek word is hypostasis. Hebrews 1 says, God in past times spoke various ways. We've taught on the stars. He spoke in the heavens. You can learn about God from what He creates. But in these last days, that's spoken unto us by His Son, the literal hypostasis or substance of God's nature moved on the stage of history. And as I've already said, tented, a military word that John uses, tented in human flesh, called Jesus of Nazareth, and revealed God in that way. And the eternal word, as some have said, became the living word to become the spoken word, to become the preached and written word. And that communicated word is the way we come now to know God at His best, though there are other avenues. Now, I don't need to limit myself to 66 books. I can teach the truth of God in just one of them. The Old Testament is enfolded in, or unfolded in the New, and the New is enfolded in the Old. But neither will I cut the top of my head off because I'm a Christian and feel my faith will be destroyed if some archaeologist digs up the hypothetical Q document that any New Testament scholar knows undergirds Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Now, Sunday night, God willing, on Channel 9, I'll be on. The question is the lost Book of Thomas, the hypothetical Q document. Now, these Nag Hammurabi digs produced Gnostic Gospels. And because so much of them are Gnostic Gospels, which are for the most part heretical and force the choice between the Eastern view of reality versus the Western, they've been in large part rejected. But included in those documents is the lost Gospel of Thomas, and it is not Gnostic, and I'll prove that to you. Thank God, even Biblical Archaeology in its monthly journals is coming to that knowledge. Now, the Gnostics, as a heresy, fly in the face of the belief that part of the reason for the timing of Christ's coming was the dominance of the New Testament world by the Greek language. Now, this is heavy stuff, but I expect an audience to listen. I come to theology from philosophy, and philosophy is behind theology. Theology is but a branch of philosophy. And your a priori philosophic positions determine what you're going to see in Scripture. Now, I grew up in the church where a lot of people said, King James, good enough for Paul, good enough for me. And I lost my faith. I never became atheistic. I just became agnostic. And I know the pain of being in a traditional church where every time you ask a question, somebody glowers at you like your first cousin to the devil and say, you just got to believe. Man, I knew that. I mean, I can read. Without faith, it's impossible to please God. That was my problem. How do you get it? I didn't find it easy to take everything for granted. But when I lost my faith, I made a mistake of thinking I could somehow graduate philosophically to some view of life that didn't require faith. There isn't any such animal. And it took philosophy, after changing majors on every degree, to finally start putting some of it together for me. The Eastern religions believe the thing that's wrong with mankind is that silly idea that you exist. You can't prove it. And I remember when I used to teach philosophy, I'd ask the old idiotic question, can a sound be heard in the woods when there's nobody there to hear it? And I'd see the look, you know. Here's another one. I mean, how do I get through this course with a passing grade and get out to the dating game? You see, when when you really know a subject, you always get down to either or. So I can't stand a guy who doesn't know his subject enough to have an opinion. I don't care if people are opinionated. Just tell me what your opinion is so I can be on guard. When you study philosophy, all mankind can be divided into two camps. And only two. You're going one way or the other. Now, philosophy, theories of reality and being, metaphysics deals with theories of what is. What is real? And ontology is a branch of it that deals with reality as being, which is personality. And the Christian faith postulates that ultimate reality is personal. Axiology deals with value. Epistemology deals with knowledge. What can be known? And it is in epistemology that all mankind divides into two camps. There are only two. You're either one or the other in your view of reality. You ready for this? I mean, I've had people tell me you can't do this on radio. You get ready, folks. I'll see if you're there when I'm done. I got a hat on. Tell me, describe this hat for me. I got to admit, you folks on radio, I'm not wearing a bikini tonight. Tell me, come on, shout it out. What's this hat? What? Tell me more. Well, somebody tell me the color. What? A light brown round pith helmet. Always a smart aleck in the crowd, isn't it? Every single time. Who? Where is it? Oh, this is the chin strap? With a yellow chin strap. What's a chin? A little thing under your mouth. What's your mouth? You guys have not told me anything other than a relationship you're having with my helmet. You got to watch it now. You got to watch it now. You haven't told me anything. You described that telephone. You're going to give me a color. You're going to give me hardness, you're going to give me weight, you're going to give me density. That's relationships. That's all you can tell me. Oh, well, some scientist is going to tell me molecules and electrons and movements. How long did it take you to understand in physics that this book, when I hold it up, hit it with my fist, is really more space than solid matter? Took a while, but we got the gestalt feel of it, that that's what was actually happening. Do I have to convince you of that, or have you had enough physics to know there's more space here and movement in this so-called solid book I'm hitting with my fist than there is solid matter? I mean, if you were a small enough atom shot through this book, you could go through it and not even know it's there. Right or wrong? You can take your descriptions of my hat, stay away from my head, and go down to molecules and atoms. You are going to describe a relationship you are having with that hat. Color is a relationship. Weight is a relationship. My hat's not half as heavy to an elephant as it is to me. I want to know what's the hat. What? Oh, that's a relationship. There are lots of people who will not feel it's ornamental, and it depends on the head whether it covers it. That's a relationship. You can't tell me anything about this hat except verbal descriptions of a relationship that we fix because of constant relationships into a noun figure. It is a foci of relationships. Right or wrong? Sure, you can say, yeah. Don't you? Brainwashed zombies is what you are. What I want to know is, what is it that's there? This book. Now, it's got an orange cover. Hurts my knuckles to hit it too often. What is there?
No, the idea is a relationship. What's there? Huh? No, imagination is a relationship too. Huh? Adam floating around, relationship with each other and with you. You ain't telling me nothing, but there is nothing you can tell me with words that isn't a relationship. Who? Space and time is a relationship. Einstein proved that. It's a relationship. Talk back to me. Don't leave it to these people. Just relationships. Huh? But thinking's a relationship, too. And on my head is a relationship. And I could be right or wrong, depending upon the accuracy of the relatedness. It's a relationship. Now, the reason it sounds so silly is we're talking in English. We think that we're free to work these things out. You were captured because you came out the gate in the wrong place. Had you been born a Navajo in a tribe that Richard Dettering at Stanford University did his doctorate dissertation on, you wouldn't have as much trouble with this as you wouldn't think I'm as crazy as you think I am right now. Now, we're doing in about 20 minutes what, if I'm lucky, I might do in 20 weeks in a college class. And then I'm not sure the gestalt would come through because our thought patterns are already captured. Now, there's only two views of reality. And there is no capacity on earth to prove which one's right. There are two philosophies of reality, epistemological positions they're called. And don't think of this word emotively. We use idealism and realism in the emotional meaning of the words and have changed the original philosophic meaning. An idealist in philosophic epistemology believes that all reality consists of is relationships. Since you can't discover or describe anything except relationships, the idealist simply says that's all there is. That's it. There isn't anything else. Just relationships. The realist, in the philosophic meaning of the word realism in epistemology, you can go buy textbooks, go down and check them out of the library. In epistemology, an idealist believes all reality consists of relationships. That's it. When you quit extending your relatedness through microscopes and other such things, you will end up with just some more relationships. There is no such thing as entities having relationships. There are only relationships. The realist says, that's a bunch of baloney. They don't really. They say, that's a bunch of bull. All right, you got me, Scott, with smart-aleck words, but I know there's something there. I can't tell you what it is, but there's something there, and I'm here, and we're related. And all those relationships connect us, but I'm here, and it's there, and I don't know what it is, but it is whatever it is, and it's having these relationships. It is blue. It is whatever color you said it was, brown. It has this or has that. That's the realist view. The idealist says, there's only the relationships. Now you say, this is just philosophic nonsense. Look, the only difference between an intelligent man and a dummy is an intelligent man knows what his frame of reference is. And a frame of reference is that which you take for granted in life and you don't seek to prove it. You act on it. And faith, by definition, has to assume something and act on it. I no longer argue about my existence. And I've never gotten philosophic enough to prove the alternative viewpoint. Neither has anybody else. I've read, and never has anybody ever done it for me. So some realist arguing with an idealist and saying, well, you don't think you exist, go walk in front of a streetcar and prove it. It's psychologically and emotionally hard to do, but the philosophic premises And depending upon your frame of reference, it affects everything you do. The idealist says there is nothing existing except relationships. The realist says there's something there. I may not be able to capture it with words, locate it, and isolate it, but there's some entity there, and the relationships connect the entities. And ultimate reality is made up of these separate entity particles. What is the significance? This country was captured in 1920 by John Dewey. Progressive education grows out of idealism and philosophy. And John Dewey knew exactly what he believed. Idealism postulates there are no absolutes because everything is but a foci of relationships. If there are such things as fixed entities, you can deduce a theological premise of immortality of the soul. If there are no such things as fixed entities, immortality of an individual is utter philosophic nonsense. I listened to Larry Thomas at Stanford weep in his final educational philosophy lecture as he spoke on the value systems and ultimate reality, what he called the ontology of an experimentalist. And experimentalism is the philosophy behind progressive education. They got the jump up on us with the emotive word progressive. There are no ultimate entities. He described life as a great ocean in which the waves are foci of relationship. You and I have no more permanence than a wave in the sea. Any immortality we have is the effect we have on the rolling waves. He said, if you want to get an abstract, felt viewpoint of reality and the impermanence of individuals, fly over the ocean low and look down and postulate a problem. It is much easier to distinguish a wave from a wave than it is to distinguish the wave from the ocean. Where does the ocean end and the wave begin? But you can have a felt temporary feel of distinction between this wave and that wave. Individuality, he said, is no more, and he was very consistent. I wish some of my Christian friends were as consistent as Larry Thomas was. Individuality is no more real than a wave in the sea. We are but a foci temporary in the stream of time, in the wave of reality. Therefore, there are no truths. There is no absolute, unchanging truth save one truth. There are no truths. The only thing that never changes is the fact that everything changes. And since everything changes, and we are but a temporary foci of relationships striving to roll out as long as we can, that which is true is that which perpetuates us, that which works for us, that which satisfies us. There is no absolute up there that this wave must bend to. Our reality begins and ends with this foci of relationships, here today, gone tomorrow. Truth, therefore, is that which works for you, and value merges with truth. Value is that which works for you, and the end, self-perpetuation and self-satisfaction, the end justifies the means, and all truth is bye-bye. He's absolutely right, if his view of reality is right. Now, progressive education was fostered on a nation, and a generation came out of it who learned how to cope theoretically with problem-solving methods for change. The way you learn became more important than what you learn. Since facts change, it's no longer important to learn facts as it is to cope with new facts. And a generation with no fixed values and no fixed lodestar of truth came on the scene. I am not an evangelist. I don't want to save anybody. I just would like people to intelligently reject Christianity because they know what it is, and I wish more people knew what they were captured into as a thought pattern of John Dewey's pragmatism. Idealism postulates no fixed realities of any kind. Realism says entities exist. Now, had God sent His Son, the ultimate revelation of truth, into a different language frame, Christianity would have been different. Gnosticism would have prevailed. Because in the fullness of time, God sent His Son in a world frame dominated by a language more precise than any language on this earth. I'm under this roof. I don't expect it to fall on me. If I were outside and rain was falling on me, or I was under falling leaves, I'd use a different Greek word. It has that precision. And our Western language comes out of that language stream, listen close, where the realist view is already forced on us. We have fixed nouns changing actions. I run, I ran home, I run home, I ran home, I will run home, I can run home, I might have run home, I maybe will run home. I and home remain unchanged. Our thought patterns from earliest youth are realistic. And it is consistent with that stream that the Grecian language, more precise than English, is fixed in that frame. Dick Dettering at Stanford found a Navajo tribe where every time the verb changes, the noun changes. If you grow up in that thought pattern, you find it easy to think in the idealistic frame. It's so hard to communicate to a Western mind because our language, I say, describe this hat. You're going to describe it with fixed nouns and pronouns and varying verbs. The actions change. The relationships change. The entities stay fixed. What's the point? Had you come out the gate in another language, you would think differently. Were your roots in the Vedanta faith, and I find people harping about yogi, some people in the Western world trying to build a religion of no religion where they graft them all together. A know-nothing grafts them all together and sees no distinctions. Respect them all and respect them enough to understand them, then make your intelligent choice. Realism is the Christian frame. Gnosticism tunes in on that idealistic frame that God is everywhere and we can tune in on His frequency and get our own source of knowledge. The Christian faith says, God's other than me. The Hebrew tradition says, it's an I-thou relationship, and since He's other than me, He must reveal Himself. And He's always been revealing Himself, and you must look for God's dialogue somewhere. Now, Paul says he dialogued with us in the stars and wrote a message there. And they've been painting it over with mythology for years. Josephus says the Sethites gave us the knowledge, preserving it, knowing a Holocaust was coming on this earth. They put one in the Euphrates River area of brick, which is no longer around. And in the first century, Josephus says, the one made of stone was standing in the land of Syriac to this day. And Syria's ought to turn you on, those doggone people. Well, I'm going to get, you don't know which night this week, but I'll be on them. You don't need a revelation if you're an idealist. You find God in yourself. I studied under Kishimoto, the Buddhist scholar who took Anasaki's place. I respect their beliefs. And I had the joy of Anasaki telling me at the end of the year of individual study, if he were a Christian, he'd have to believe in the resurrection. Now, these watered down Christianities that don't exist in history are the ones that trouble me. Christianity is realistic in its epistemology. Christianity postulates that God created something other than Himself, and that the relationship is external. Dialogue and that God, to communicate with us, will not communicate from within us, but will communicate from without us to us. You say, what about the Holy Spirit in us? You'll find an identity, but that Spirit still comes from without to us, not from within outward. A lot of you evangelical Christians, as much as I admire Watchman Nee and his successor Witness Lee, you have to be aware of the fact that they come out of the idealistic frame and they are forever seeking to merge that viewpoint. I respect it. It simply will not mix and will not fly with the realism of epistemology in the New Testament Greek. And God's been dialoguing. He dialogued in the pyramid. That's what we've been teaching. He dialogued in the stars. He dialogued with a chosen people that He made His oracle and made them custodians of His truth. And when they wouldn't do what He wanted them to do, He literally entered into their life stream until He controlled the drama of their history in such a way it would teach. You tell me that I can't find any message anywhere else. God spoke through a jackass to Balaam, and he was on the fringe of the heathen. Now, the Bible speaks of the book of Jasher, and there is a fake one. The Rosicrucians did. But the book of Jasher that is referred to in the Bible was not written by some old guy named Jasher. It's the book of the upright. That's what the word Jasher means. Got another book that everybody's going to try to get now. I did it here with you one night. I proved we found the text where the Bible refers to them, right? So if the King James is good enough for Paul, King James refers to the book of Jasher. Now, here's the Hebrew preface to the book. It has at this time been ascertained by us that when the holy city Jerusalem was destroyed by Titus, all the military heads went in to rob and plunder, and that amongst the officers of Titus was one whose name was Sidras. He went in to search and found in Jerusalem a house of great extent, and took away all the spoils which he found there. When he wished to go out of the house, he looked at the wall and fancied, hey, I forgot. I'm supposed to tell you whether that guy found the Ark of the Covenant and sold it to Rothschilds. Next Sunday night, on Channel 9. When he wished to go out of the house, he looked at the wall and fancied that he saw treasures there. So he broke down the wall and the building and found a cask full of various books of the law, the prophets, and the hagiographa. Also, are you bored?
No, sir.
You want to hear any more of this or not?
Yes, sir.
Give me, I want to know. If I don't get these phones jammed in 20 seconds, I'm going home. In fact, my inclination is to go home anyway, so you better call. You got 20 seconds. I got some teachers out there wanting some more on progressive education. I did a master's and a general secondary teaching credential before anybody ever. In fact, there were no courses in philosophy of education available at that time under the doctor's program. Yet my master teacher would not approve me for a general secondary credential unless I, in essence, adopted, quote, progressive education. A whole generation was released into the school system, teaching a method that presupposed a philosophy they didn't even know, until we reached the shipwreck of modern education. There's only one explanation for the shipwreck of American education, and that's the takeover by progressive education, fostered out of the 20s, hitting its stride in the 40s, booming into the 50s. The teachers came out of the California system at Cal and Stanford thinking progressive education was the only way to fly, based upon a principle that denies any values other than values that you individually find satisfying. The self, the individual, became the criteria of value. And that's why we then had a generation so abandoned into emptiness that the cults came along and grabbed them because they offered them something to commit to. It's based upon a worldview of reality where there's nothing permanent or nothing fixed. Like it or lump it. The Christian faith and the Hebrew faith postulate a center of authority. That's why we call it the Old and New Testament. Trace your English words in their etymological roots. A testament is a covenant. God is a covenant-making God. When relationships are external, you bind yourself with covenants. God is a covenant-making God. He makes covenants. Now, we make covenants. You relate to people with covenants, either oral or written. We make covenants that are jointly produced. There's only one place where we have a covenant that is so singular that one person writes all the terms. Our last will and testament. A testament is a singular covenant. I play God. I'm right. Who gets my tennis shoes? Nobody else can have them. I spell it out. That's a testament. That's why we call the Old and New Testament testament. It's a covenant, but one-sided. God's a hardhead. He does not bargain or compromise. He lays down the terms by which he will relate. That doesn't make him legalistic or harsh. He transcended his own law and gave his son to open the door of new relatedness in the New Testament concept of grace. But it's still a testament. One-sided agreements. And Christianity forces man to accept. Well, it doesn't force anybody to do anything. But when the last chapter is written, you'll find out who's right.
This is the end of Side 1.